My name is Charles Lutz, and this is a session on the tension between faithfulness to the will of God in one's life and the requirements of human authority when the two conflict. It's sometimes called the issue of civil disobedience, and that's all right, but that tends to stress the negative. I think it's better to stress the issue of faithfulness to the requirements of God. Thus, divine obedience or divine faithfulness in conflict with the requirements of human order when that leads to a tension. I have put on the board an outline of what I propose to cover. I've subtitled it A Matter of Dual Loyalties, and I would suggest that both of those loyalties are legitimate ones, but when they conflict, what do we do about that? The problem is, I'm going to try to define the problem, say something in overview about the biblical witness on the issue. The Bible spends a fair amount of time talking about that tension, both Old and New Testaments. A look at classical civil disobedience theory, which doesn't necessarily come out of Christian or religious origins. It goes back to Greek thought prior to the time of Christ and down through many secular philosophers of human order. Some special considerations that we need to look at when we look at it within the context of the faith community. Then, depending on how much time we have, a recognition of some of the special or the present issues in the United States that pose it for us. Why is it before us in the first place? And then finally, what can the churches say and do in response to the question? My work is with the American Lutheran Church in the area of helping the church to develop its social witness and then conveying that witness to various centers of power in our society, primarily federal government. We do the representation of our church body to the federal government, both Congress and the administration, and we also convey church positions on social questions and ethical considerations to corporations in which we invest. Corporations and banks. Those are the primary two places where we do advocacy. This is an issue or involves considerations where we have been very active in conveying positions to the federal government, calling for change in law or change in the interpretation of law, particularly with immigration law and the situation of undocumented persons. We'll return to that later. I hope we'll have time to get into that in some depth. The issue of caring for the stranger and sojourner in our midst who is here without legal status. Primarily that focuses these days around Salvadorans, some Guatemalans, some scattered few from other places in the world who have not been recognized as legal refugees by the interpretation of our own law. As you know, many church people, Christians, other religious groups, congregations in many cases have been giving sanctuary to such people. That is a violation of law if it is interpreted that they're giving haven to people who are not legally in the United States. I think this is a good subject to talk about in the wake of July 4, because yesterday in the forum, and even if you weren't in the forum, there was among us a lot of thinking about allegiance to nation. And what does that mean? What does it mean to be loyal to one's country? So on the 5th of July, the next day, I think this is an appropriate time to talk more about that. I think the central issue in all of this is, what does one do, what does one of religious faith, what does a believer do when she or he believes that faithfulness to God's call on that person's life leads to conflict with the civil order of which one is a part? I think that's particularly a problem when the civil order one is a part of is not tyrannical at all, but is a very good, decent, humane order, relatively speaking. I would expect that in some less humane orders that we can think of, both historically and today, the issues are more clear-cut. This is not a good human authority anyway. It does evil. It doesn't reward the good and punish the evil. It's the opposite of that. Therefore, I'm under no obligation to obey it. But when you do feel an obligation, most of the time, to be obedient to the authority you are a part of, when you believe also that you have an opportunity to participate in changing that order in shaping it, if you don't believe its laws are just, in revising its laws. What then? I think it's particularly, therefore, an issue for people who live in an order such as ours, which for most of us has been relatively good and humane. And I think also, relatively speaking, among human orders, seeking after justice. At least in our words, we try to do that. We don't always achieve our goals, but we are committed. Whether it's our constitution or other kinds of laws, we are committed to the goal of justice for all. Some current cases that raise it, I'll just mention them and then we'll return to them later. They tend to be in three broad areas. One is government regulation of religious institutions. That presents an issue of conscience for some. I think particularly among the more conservative Christians, but it may be across the board. Let me just mention two specific concerns. The issue of state regulation of religious schools. State-required certification of grammar schools, elementary schools, and high schools. You may remember the case in Nebraska in recent years. Lewisburg, I think, was the town name. Louisville? Okay. Small town in Nebraska. I don't even know where it is in Nebraska, but... Okay, so it's not far from Omaha, between Omaha and Lincoln somewhere, it must be. A Baptist congregation there had and has a school. The state of Nebraska, at the time it became an issue, required state certification, required all schools, public and private, to be certified by the state. The Baptist community there said that was an unwise, unnecessary, and as they viewed it, unjust intrusion on their freedom. And as a result, out of conscience, some of the leaders of that congregation, lay and clergy, went to jail for a time. They refused to comply. It was a conscience issue. They said it was, in their eyes, not appropriate for the state to have such a requirement. They resisted. That was civil disobedience. They didn't run away and hide. They were willing to take the penalty which the law required. I'm not sure how willing they were, but they did take that penalty, which is part of the classical civil disobedience theory, that you don't thumb your nose at the law, you pay the penalty the law extracts as part of your witness to what you believe. Well, they did that. I understand, maybe you know, Paul, the details of it. I understand they have arrived at an accommodation with the state and the legislature changed the law. Okay, which tells us that one way of getting law changed is to be willing to go to jail for what you believe, and especially if you get a lot of press attention. It may help to get the law changed. That's, I think, Martin Luther King used a similar strategy 20 years ago in the U.S. That's one area of governmental regulation of religious institutions. Another one that is of concern to relatively few, I think, but they feel it very deeply, congregations are now required, it used to be optional, to pay Social Security taxes for their lay employees. That is a relatively new requirement of IRS, and some congregations have said that is an illegitimate taxation by government of religious institutions. That's how they interpret it, not as a tax for the benefit of the employee primarily, but a tax on the religious institution, which they must pay whether they choose to or not. And some of them had been willing to do it on a voluntary basis, but they will not do it when it's a requirement. And for them, that's a matter of conscience. Still, other Christians have said it is a matter of conscience for them, which they wish to resist by disobeying the law, to have to pay taxes for publicly funded abortions. It's another kind of issue. It tends to be favored by, I think, more conservative Christians, but not universally so in terms of theological position there across the board. The major issues that came before our church for consideration, and these were real practical issues that were raised by congregations or others, had to do with other areas: military policy, current U.S. military policy, and current U.S. immigration policy. In the area of military policy, a whole set of issues surrounding violation of trespass law to make a witness at military installations and arms manufacturing plants. Military installations, I'll just mention one that's familiar to people in this part of the country, probably familiar to people all over the country if they're following that sort of thing. John Nelson, a Lutheran campus pastor, more than once deliberately violated a trespass law at somewhere Puget Sound. Bangor, Washington. Earlier on, I don't recall what the issue was, but the second one was the arrival or the intention of the government to bring the Trident submarine into Puget Sound, into that base. John went to his campus ministry board at the University of Washington and said, "Folks, I'm proposing to break the law. Out of my own sense of what God calls me to do, I feel I must do this. I'm proposing to do it. I'm going to make it very public. I'm going to tell people what I plan to do." And they said, okay, he'd done that before. That's where John was. They understood that. Then he said, "Now, wait a minute. I've got a request to you this time. I want to ask that you pay half of my salary while I'm in jail." And at that point, the board said, "Now, hold on a minute. This will involve us as an expression of the institutional church with the money given by a constituency over which we are steward, and much of that constituency does not agree with your conscience. They're willing for you to do what your conscience requires. We're not sure they're willing for us to use their money to do in support of your family while you're in jail." So they didn't have any real guidance from their parent church bodies, that board. They went to their national board, which Jim Carr is the executive of. Jim isn't here, is he? Jim knows this story very well. They went to National Lutheran Campus Ministry Board and said, "What should we do?" And that board said, "We do not have any policy from our church bodies on this kind of question." So then they turned to primarily the two large churches, LCA and ALC, and said, "Help us." And so out of that request, along with some other requests like it, we did this. This is the result. Because they wondered, what is the guidance of our church bodies on a question of this kind, the institutional involvement in using resources of the church to stand with someone who is planning civil disobedience. As it turned out, that case never came to trial. John and his mother, the late Ruth Youngdahl Nelson, and a number of others went out in small boats, violated the order not to trespass, not to go across the bow of the Trident. They did it. They were arrested, released almost immediately, and the government dropped charges. And the suspicion is that the government dropped the charges because the government saw no gain for it in pursuing that kind of prosecution. I don't know. The government has its own reasons for not prosecuting. But they did not prosecute, so John, in that case, did not go to jail. That's one. Honeywell in the Twin Cities, similar things in other parts of the country, people who deliberately violate a trespass law in order to make a witness at a defense plant. And that goes on and on. I think in the Twin Cities now, over the last few years, there have been more than 1,000 arrested and in some cases fined, in some cases jailed for a short term, like 10 days. For some others, under military policy also, there comes the question of objecting to military service in a way that is not legal. Our law provides for conscientious objection if you can demonstrate to the conscription system that you're opposed to all wars. If you are, in effect, a pacifist, that whatever war they give, you ain't going. If you have that sincere belief and you can demonstrate it to your draft board, then you can be not relieved from the draft, but relieved from combatant service. That is, you don't have to bear arms. And then you can opt for civilian alternative service or non-combatant military service. That is not a problem, it seems to me, for most people who are in that category because the law provides. What is a problem is where most Lutherans and Catholics and Methodists and non-peace church young people are, which is selective participation or objection to warfare. It depends. It depends on circumstances and criteria. It depends on the nature of the military enterprise. So the Vietnam War, for many, was such an issue. It was not what was considered by them a just war. And many of them learned that in their churches, that on the basis of traditional unjust war criteria, this one was unjust. The other issue, and that's not currently an issue except academically, it's not a practical issue because we're not conscripting anybody currently. We are, however, conscripting taxes from all of us to pay for wars and war purposes and military purposes. And thus there are some who say, it's the same kind of issue, in conscience I cannot use my money, which is myself, at least voluntarily, I cannot let that be used to pay for weapons, and particularly for nuclear weapons. I think it's been joined at that point for many people who say they really believe that in the kind of world we live in, some kind of conventional military force is necessary for policing. But they do not believe that that nuclear weapons can ever be used justifiably, and therefore they don't want to pay for nuclear weapons with their tax dollars. So there are, as you know, some who are looking for ways of withholding their payment of taxes, at least for a portion of the military budget. That, for them, is a conscience question. That is, they believe, some of them, believers among them, believe that that is what God is calling them to. And I suppose then the biggest issue of all right now is immigration policy. How do believers who read the Bible and hear that we are to take care of those in our midst who are sojourners and strangers, how do we respond to them and provide haven for them when that may put us in violation of our own government's law? Undocumented Salvadorans, I suppose, is the primary, the most publicized example of that. Now, it seems to me the problem, the basic problem in all of this is that allowing for disobedience, for those who feel called in conscience to disobey human authority, there's clear biblical and theological tradition that says you have to allow for that. You have to respect conscience. There's secular authority that says the same thing, that you cannot require people to go against their conscience, even if their conscience is wrong or misguided. But how do you allow for that without encouraging disrespect for law itself, disrespect for the idea of law, disrespect for the framework, the fabric by which a society holds itself together under law? Or some would even go farther and say, how do you allow for that without opening the camel's nose is now in the tent? Maybe the original advocates are well-intentioned, and yes, they will abide by the general rules of civil disobedience, but that will mislead others, and pretty soon you'll have anarchy and chaos. I think that's the problem. That's what troubles people as they look at this issue. In our study of it in congregations, we had, in response, a lot of interesting comments came back. A lot of people really appreciated the chance to dig into it. They took it very seriously, and they struggled with it. There were some who said things that I think were very blatant in indicating where they were, particularly some individuals. It really raised the question for them of where, I would say, they didn't say this, of where their God is. And for some, it was clear that the real God for some people is human order or my nation. They would say things like that. I can understand how you'd talk about this subject in communist Russia or in some other tyrannical state, but why would you want to raise the question in a good society like ours, one of the best that has ever been designed, if not the best? Almost an identification of the United States of America with God's kingdom on earth. One I remember very clearly wrote back and said, if you have to choose between disobeying your own government, your own nation, your own state, your own locale, your own human authority, and God, it is better to disobey God, because if you disobey your own authority, you can get in a lot of trouble, first of all, but you also lead other people into doing the same, and that leads to chaos. Whereas if you disobey God, there's forgiveness. Okay? Now, I'm not suggesting that that was a majority opinion, but there were some who responded in that way. Biblical witness on this. Well, as I'll try to do a quick survey of it. I think you're generally familiar with it. I think overall the Bible indicates there's a variety of testimony on the subject, but I think the overall bottom line is that our ultimate allegiance must always be to the absolute one, to God, and that we owe allegiance, says, to all kinds of other entities and persons and institutions, but those are always relative. Thus, we owe relative allegiance to all relative authorities, including nations and any kinds of human authorities, I would say even to our spouses. That's a relative allegiance. The only one to whom absolute allegiance is owed is the absolute one. However, as I said, there's a variety of testimonies in the scripture, and some of that is summarized at the very beginning of this document. Two words that involve Peter, or at least the letter that's attributed to Peter, 1 Peter 2, 12 to 14, 13 and 14, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to praise those who do right. Almost an echo of a Pauline, often quoted Pauline word, which is in Romans chapter what? Romans where? Romans 13. Romans 13, which talks about being obedient to human authority. I think in the context of the whole scripture, you have to conclude that those are true statements. They are part of the body of the witness of the scriptures and of the faith, but they are relative. Because, by the example of the apostles themselves, when there was a test between that kind of allegiance and allegiance to God, it was always God who won out. Peter and the apostles answered, Acts 5:29, we must obey God rather than men. If you go back into the Old Testament scriptures, you have the example of the disobedience of the Hebrew midwives, who feared God rather than carry out the Pharaoh's orders. Pharaoh's orders were to use their access to these young children to do away with the children of the Israelites. That was civil disobedience they engaged in. Or the prophets. Very often the prophets write against the human kings of Israel that Israel must follow the will of God, not the directives of the human kings. St. Paul violates Roman law frequently. He does things that get him thrown in jail or violates the law of localities under the Roman authority. And yet St. Paul always appeals to the Roman law and his citizenship and his right to due process. That's how he is to be treated, you'll remember. He always appeals to that. Because he is a Roman citizen, he has certain rights. So he uses the framework of human law at the same time that he is in trouble for violating human law. In Reformation times, it was clear. Luther, in his writings, very often appealed to the same kind of distinction. Acts 5:29 was often quoted by Luther. This quote from his treatise on good works, 1520, that's reproduced here. You can read it for yourselves. The Augsburg Confession, in a similar kind of summary statement, Article 16, says, the gospel does not overthrow civil authority, the state, and marriage. The Lutheran movement needed to say that as over against the Anabaptists, those who became Mennonites and some of the more radical Reformation movements, because they were saying that the gospel replaces human civil authority. The Lutherans said, no, it does not. Marriage, the state, even going to war, serving as a soldier, remains in place if it's a just war. Accordingly, Christians are obliged to be subject to civil authority and to obey its commands and laws in all that can be done without sin. But when commands of the civil authority cannot be obeyed without sin, we must obey God rather than men, Acts 5:29. Okay. Classical civil disobedience theory, let me just say a couple things briefly about that and then look at some of its principles, which we do summarize in the pamphlet. Two kinds of civil disobedience have generally been recognized. One is direct civil disobedience, that is, when the law itself is a problem. The law itself requires me to do something which violates my conscience. This doesn't need to be religiously informed conscience. It could be entirely in secular terms. I think Thoreau did not, as far as I know, appeal to what God expects of me when he refused to pay taxes for the Mexican War. He simply believed the Mexican War was unjust on our part, it was aggressive, and therefore he would not pay taxes to support it, and he was thrown in jail. And then there was the famous line, when Ralph Waldo Emerson came to visit him, Ralph said, Henry, what are you doing in jail? Why are you in jail? And his response was, Ralph, why are you not in jail? What are you doing out there? So he was doing that, I take it, basically out of his own conviction as a human being, without any particular, at least he didn't write about it, sense that this is what God called him to do. But that was direct civil disobedience. The law itself requires me to do something I believe I cannot do. Indirect civil disobedience is when the violation is the vehicle for protesting something else. The law itself that is being broken is not a problem. It's not a conscience problem. When Martin Luther King violated trespass laws in the South, or sat in at lunch counters, or did any number of things, even breaking traffic laws, and got arrested for that in certain cases. I remember Albany, Georgia. I think the charge was that they formed a crowd and wouldn't disperse. Well, the law they were breaking was not the problem of conscience. The law they were trying to call attention to that was unjust was Jim Crow law. It was law that segregated the races and made that kind of behavior legal. That's what they were protesting. But the laws they were charged with breaking were other laws. Thus, that was indirect civil disobedience. Trespass law at military bases, what John Nelson was charged with, that was indirect civil disobedience. That distinction is important because I think the way of looking at the two categories of civil disobedience may be different. There are some who say, I will support those who are engaged in direct civil disobedience, that is, breaking laws that for them, the keeping of which would be against their conscience. I will not support those who contrive to go out and break laws protesting at Honeywell. There are other ways to do that, and I don't support that kind of thing. So you get that sort of distinction being made. Five principles in classical civil disobedience theory. There may be more, there may be fewer, but these are the five that we use in this document. Civil disobedience must always be undertaken as a last resort. That is, you have to seek to change the law first by legal means, electoral, judicial, whatever. Elect different people, try to get a court ruling. A few years ago, Lutherans in this country were pursuing a test case involving the IRS because a new regulation required that certain forms be filed by church groups saying that they didn't have to pay income taxes because of certain status, and they protested the requirement that they had to fill out that form, and they tested it in the courts and won. They did that legally, although they did break a law in doing it. They refused to file the form, and that was technically a violation of the law, and then it went to court. But their goal was to get it into the courts for a judgment. Some of the Lutheran social service agencies were involved in that. And the question, really, a legal question was, were they fully a part of the church, or were they integrated auxiliaries of the church, or were they something else? Were they not part of the church itself? Because churches don't have to file those forms. So, as a last resort, you can debate when you reach the point of last resort, because you probably never get absolutely to last resort. But the point of that is that you have to try other means first. That's part of classical CD theory. A second principle is that you do it only by nonviolent means. Civil disobedience is nonviolent. It does not do violence to persons or to property. So that some of, you know, if you insist on that, not violence to property, some of the so-called civil disobedience of recent years, going into Sperry Univac in St. Paul a couple years ago, folks went in and with a hammer destroyed some computers that were related, as they thought, to the making of weaponry. That wouldn't qualify classically as civil disobedience because it destroyed property. But that's one of the tests. A third one is always for the sake of the larger community. That is, not just to satisfy a personal whim or to keep my own hands clean, but it's supposed to have some larger benefit, some witness to the larger community about an injustice. A fourth principle is always with respect for the consciences of others. You don't necessarily agree with where others are in their conscience, but you respect the fact that they too have consciences, and that has to be honored even as you are taking actions that say, I disagree with where you are. We'll return to that later. Finally, always with willingness to accept the consequences. And I think that's very important. It seems to me that a big part of the witness, maybe the biggest part of the witness of civil disobedience, if your objective is to get the society to face up to an issue of injustice, one of the major elements in that witness is that you're willing to pay the penalty, which the law requires, of going to jail or paying the fine or whatever. That's why I personally have trouble with people who do acts of civil disobedience in order to make a witness to something they don't believe in, and then try every legal means of getting out of the penalty, getting off, getting declared not guilty. I have personal problems with that, because it seems to me that part of the reason you do civil disobedience is to make the witness, and the strongest way of making the witness that you deeply believe in this is to be willing to go to jail for it or pay whatever penalty. Christians further recognize, beyond these five principles, that conscience is tainted by sin and therefore can be mistaken, that even the conscience of the one who, in all sincerity, says, "I believe God calls me to this," could be wrong. It could be a misreading. Christians, therefore, are well advised not to decide alone, but to seek the counsel of the Christian community, to work it through together in study and prayer with fellow believers. Most of our congregations are not noted for that, dealing in the congregational community with that kind of divisiveness. But I do recall a couple years ago when a member of the congregation I belong to in South Minneapolis was planning on the following day, Monday morning, to be arrested at Honeywell. She said to the congregation on the Sunday prior, in the announcement time, "Folks, here's what I'm planning to do tomorrow. I would very much like to talk with some of you if you are interested in discussing it with me after church today or whenever, before tomorrow morning. I'd like to talk with you about my reasons for doing it, and I'd like to know what your thinking is." She knew that we had a lot of Honeywell employees who, for the most part, did not think that was a good idea and thought it brought a bad name to Honeywell that was undeserved, and that tension continues. I don't know if she got any takers. I know she made the offer, and I think that's a responsible way to proceed. Would have been better if she'd offered it some months before, I think, but I guess she had just decided that weekend that she would participate. By the way, on that following Monday morning, our pastor was out there with them. He did not cross the line. He did not get arrested he did not break the law, but he was there in support of her and with others who were trying to show support as that event occurred. Some special considerations that I think we need to keep in mind. I think we need to distinguish in the church community between what is possible for an individual and what is possible for institutional expressions of the church. And those are not, I think, in most cases, identical. For the church as an institution, we say in the statement, it is important to keep some distinction between what is possible for individuals and what is possible for institutional expressions of the church. Violation of law in the name of a corporate entity, such as a congregation, will have legal implications for all members. Thus, all members should be involved in any decision about a proposed disobedient act. It is wise to make such a decision by consensus. Well, what is consensus? I think the way the Quakers use the term, it does not mean unanimity. It may be unanimity, but they define consensus as no one objecting, which is a little different from unanimity. Unanimity would mean 100% vote for. Consensus might mean 88% vote for and 12% abstaining. That is saying, I will not stand in the way of you, the bulk of us, collectively doing this, even though I have personal problems with it. I will not object to it for the sake of the community. That's consensus. That's hard to get to. What it's trying to say is you don't decide as a congregation to do sanctuary on the basis of a 51% majority. That's a prescription for trouble, for division in the parish. What should be if you're going to take a majority vote, what should it be? I don't know. I think consensus is the ideal, but it seems to me something like 80, 85, 90% would be advisable. Second point is the role of parish pastors, because parish pastors are not only individuals, they are also, in a way, collective representatives of the community to the larger society. So we say on that point, a special word must be spoken about the role of parish pastors. We felt this was necessary because often it is the parish pastor within a congregation who feels most strongly about some act of disobedience that must be done. And the people may not necessarily agree with the pastor. There may be times when a pastor believes his or her Christian faith is leading him or her to an act of disobedience as a believing individual. Yet the congregation may vehemently object on grounds that their consciences do not lead them in the same way, and their pastor is to be a public example of the faith we are all called to exhibit, as well as to be a public representative of that congregation in the eyes of the community. In other words, if the pastor does it, people will conclude that The pastor is doing it in the name of this congregation which he or she serves, and therefore all of us agree with the pastor. Then we go on. There is need for great caution and understanding on both sides of such a disagreement. If a satisfactory resolution cannot be reached, it may be necessary for a pastor to resign rather than violate conscience on a matter of deep conviction. I remember about 5 years ago, there was an LCA pastor in Great Falls, Montana. Can't remember his name. Some of you may know the story. He believed that he was called to go over the fence and thus violate a trespass law at, is it Malmstrom Air Base near Great Falls? I think that's the name of it, Malmstrom Air Base. He did that, and his congregation, for the most part, was very unhappy about it because it was highly publicized and the congregation's name was identified with the act of the pastor. And the congregation said, we do not agree with our pastor in this. This is his own decision. Well, eventually he had to leave, or he did leave. I assume he was under pressure to go somewhere else because the congregation and the people had a great disagreement over that act. I don't know how much prior work he'd done with them about it, but he did it, and they did not support him in it. That's not uncommon, that kind of tension between pastor and people. Another pastor I know was interested in reducing legally the amount of taxes he had to pay, so he asked his congregation, because of a concern with military budget, so he asked his church council to let him take a cut in his salary, and they asked why. That was very unusual, and he explained why, and they said, but that's disloyal to our country. You ought to take that and pay those taxes. And as a result of that, they had a parting of the ways. And that may at times be the best solution, rather than to try to work out what you cannot compromise about. The pastor felt that he couldn't compromise on that point. A third consideration, the church as community. Now this is what seems clear to me and what's what the document says. You may disagree with it. It seems to me and to the document that the church as community must stand by persons who are acting from a sincerely held conscientious conviction, even when that faith community as a whole disagrees with them. I know in the Vietnam War there were many young men, not a lot of Lutherans, but a few. There were more Roman Catholics and more in other traditions who were selective objectors to participation in that war. They had no legal place to stand. Their communities of faith, their congregations, parishes, priests, pastors, in some cases stood with them despite the fact that they disagreed. They felt they ought to have gone and served. But if that's where they were, sincerely, they would stand by them and minister to them. In other congregations, that did not happen. And I think that's unfortunate. In other words, can we get to a point in the church where even if the majority of us disagree with this one person or handful of persons who are about to do this disobedience, that we can stand with them and be in ministry with them even if we think they're wrong, even after we've tried to persuade them that they're wrong and they didn't change their minds? That is hard for us to do in the community of faith, but I think we must struggle with it. It's hard for us to do because we're not comfortable with conflict, especially in the congregations. Within a given congregation, it's very difficult for us to deal with conflict around a highly emotional issue, as these tend to be.
Chuck, can I interrupt at the moment?
Yep.
What would it mean to stand by?
I'll get to that in a minute, because we spell that out in the document. That was an issue of great discussion. What does it mean to stay in ministry with? And we've tried to say what it does mean and what we think it does not mean. Finally, on the point about binding the consciences of others, one of the things that came back from the study was, yeah, you say we should respect the conscience of those who feel they must disobey the law. What about the conscience of the rest of us? Do they respect my conscience if I disagree with them? So we included this kind of language. There is a dilemma to try to say anything helpful about the role of the conscience of believers without the statement itself being heard as binding the consciences of believers. That is, you say respect the conscience of those who feel they must dissent from this law and disobey it. What about the conscience of others? Do they have to be bound by that? The goal, we go on, is to affirm conscientious Christian civil disobedience according to the principles summarized above without excluding those who disagree. Thus, we repeat, in seeking to respond to the conscientious actions of those who feel compelled to acts of civil disobedience, the church must be equally concerned about respecting the conscientiously held convictions of all who hold another view. Present situation, I've mentioned trespass law, I've mentioned and military protesting military policies, I've mentioned the conscription of persons or taxes. Let me move on and not say any more about that. I do want to say something, however, about immigration and sanctuary. There is a biblical tradition that is very powerful, that we are called to respect and to care for those who are widows, orphans, and exiles in the land. They are lifted up repeatedly. Why? Well, one of the reasons is because you, Israel, were once an exile in Egypt. You were once sojourners in the land of Pharaoh. Therefore, now you remember what that was like, and you should be taking care of refugees, exiles, strangers and sojourners in your own land. There's even a strong statement in Exodus 22. I don't have the Bible here, but Exodus 22, 21 to 24 suggests that if you do not care for the exiles in your midst, God will require your life. We talked about it in capital punishment discussion the other day, that one of the Old Testament provisions for the death penalty was if you fail to care for the strangers and sojourners. Well, that's pretty harsh. There are about a dozen Lutheran congregations as of this moment that have declared themselves publicly to be sanctuaries for Central Americans who are undocumented. Many more than that are doing sanctuary without making a public statement about it. One of the congregations I know best in this area is El Zona Lutheran Church in Phoenix. Any of you know about El Zona? It has recently declared itself to be a sanctuary, but long before it made that public statement, it was doing sanctuary. It was doing safe haven ministry for Salvadorans. El Zona is one of the churches that was infiltrated in the past year by government informers to prepare the case against, I think it was 16, who were indicted as violating U.S. immigration law across the country, but most of them in the Southwest. El Zona had a Sunday evening Bible study for Hispanics in the Spanish language. Most of the people who attended were Salvadorans who were undocumented. They found out after the indictments were handed down that there was a government informer who had infiltrated that Bible study group, and everyone thought, because it was a Spanish-speaking person, looked like the others, that this was a member of or part of the group of Central Americans who were coming. It turned out it was a government informer. So El Zona has felt very threatened by all of that. Some of its staff, including the wife of the pastor there, his name is Oinas. The pastor's wife was listed as an unindicted co-conspirator. A Catholic sister who was working with that parish with the Central Americans was indicted as a conspirator. So this comes very close to home when some of our Lutheran congregations are involved with it and are under the legal gun. With sanctuary, there is still the unresolved question of who is really breaking the law. Because many of those doing sanctuary say, we are not breaking the law, God's or our own nation's law, because our own nation's law says, this is the Immigration Act of 1980, and it agrees with international law, it uses some of the same language as the UN code. A refugee is anyone who has a well-founded fear of persecution if forced to return to the country of origin. That's what a refugee is. Well, do Salvadorans have that fear? Most of them claim that they do, that that's why they left. It's a civil war situation. Some of them say they fear both sides, both the government and the guerrillas, if they are forced to return. So our government's interpretation of our own refugee law is that Salvadorans as a group do not qualify. Who does qualify? Well, Cubans, Poles, and historically groups from other countries are given that status by group. Status, or by group, by category. Salvadorans have not been given that status. So they can appeal for it on a case-by-case basis, but they have been getting it at a rate of 2 to 3%, and many don't even try for it because they feel the odds are so bad they won't get it anyway, and they don't want to have that kind of public attention, because if you apply for it and don't get it, then you're deported. So it's quite risky. Whereas Iranians, we've been giving it on a case-by-case basis at a rate of about 75%. So our own behavior, some say, as a country, is itself at least questionable and at worst a violation of our own law. In other words, Salvadorans ought to be recognized as refugees under our own law. Finally, and here we come to the question of what does remain in ministry with? The policy of this church body, adopted last fall, appears on pages 19 and 20, and you can read it all for yourself. I will just point to certain parts of it. The American Lutheran Church asserts its commitment to the claims of discipleship in the gospel, which in particular circumstances may call believers to disobedience of a civil law they consider to be in clear violation of established Christian commitments to the sacredness of life, to peace, to justice, to freedom, or to the independence of religious organizations from improper government regulation. The American Lutheran Church promises to remain in ministry with those who, having seriously reviewed all the points above, make decisions of Christian conscience to undertake actions of civil disobedience without implying corporate agreement with particular stands taken. This affirmation includes actions of individual Christians, groups, pastors, and congregations. And the footnote, which is so fine I can hardly read it, says, to remain in ministry with implies, one, no breaking of the fellowship of the faith community because of disagreement over particular acts of civil disobedience. That is, this is not reason to throw people out of membership in the church or to say you can no longer have fellowship with us. Two, to remain in ministry with implies support through prayer, counsel, pastoral care, and acts of love on behalf of those who are in violation of law. Three, and this was inserted at the request of our lawyers, I'm a little bit uncomfortable about it, but I want to explain how I think it's to be interpreted. Three, it implies no commitment on part of the ALC, that's the national denomination, to provide financial or legal support for persons who engage in acts of civil disobedience. It also says, by silence, that the ALC would not be forbidden from doing that if it chose, but it is not to be understood as being required. And the lawyers said, if you don't put that in, people who engage in acts of civil disobedience on the basis of the overall tenor of this document may believe they can come to their national church and say, well, you've said this, and therefore you have to pay my court costs. You have to defend me. So the lawyers wanted us to put that in. But nowhere does it say or imply that the church body could not choose to do that if it wished. And in fact, we have in a way, done that already by entering a friend of the court brief, an amicus brief, with one of the cases of prosecution of church workers in South Texas. Some of you probably read about that case, Stacy Merkt. The ALC has entered a friend of the court brief, and that has involved a little bit of legal cost, not much. So, and for congregations that are engaged in whatever, or have people engaged in whatever kind of civil disobedience, if they choose to help those people also with legal costs, they are certainly free to do that.